Fantastic. Do you think you're ready?
Yes, I'm ready.
Very good. Welcome.
Welcome.
Thank you for being before the court.
The court and the board just put out this week asked us to address the appellate jurisdiction issue, and I think it's appropriate we address that first. There is no outstanding counterclaims for enforceability or invalidity. There was, in the original complaint, a claim for unenforceability and invalidity, but the district court, in its discretion, proper to Sixth Circuit law, federal circuit law, declined to rule on those. So all of the issues.
Because they were framed in a declaratory judgment complaint?
Yes.
Yes. If they had been in a direct complaint, there would not have been any discretion to skip.
I don't know how you would frame that in a declaratory judgment action. If there had been a original complaint.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
For patent infringement, which would be the other way, and there was counterclaims for invalidity and enforceability, it would be appropriate for those to be considered. But under the Sixth Circuit law and the Federal Circuit,
what about the fact that the judge never mentioned unenforceability? She mentioned invalidity and said, in essence, I don't care to reach that. But she didn't say anything at all about unenforceability.
No, she did, because that wasn't an issue before her. She ruled on the infringement issue.
What do you mean it wasn't an issue before her? It was raised in the plea.
It was raised before
her. And it was never abandoned, was it?
No, it was never abandoned.
And why is it not before her?
It was before her. Okay. The point is that under Sixth Circuit law and Supreme Court law, she has the discretion not to rule on those issues.
But where did she exercise that discretion when she never mentioned unenforceability?
Oh, it was in footnote 12, I believe. She did it in terms of invalidity. I don't think she did it.
But invalidity and unenforceability aren't the same thing.
Oh, I agree with that.
From patent law 101.
I agree with that. I agree with that completely. But obviously, she knew that that was before her. She had motions for summary judgment brought by Mr. Monti on that issue. So it was clear that issue.
So you're saying we should read her reference to invalidity being an issue that she could discretionarily skip to also cover unenforceability?
I'm suggesting that what you read is read her judgment, and her judgment says that she found the final judgment and she closed the case. That's on page 19.
She certainly said that.
And
whether it's true or not maybe is debatable, but she certainly said it.
She said that, and
we bound by that. If a judge said, this is a final judgment because I say so.
I think that it's not necessary for her to specifically say that she is declining to rule on the enforceability issue. I think that you read footnote 12 as saying that she is declining to rule on the other issues, which she has discretionary to do. That's the point.
She didn't say other issues. She said it's invalidity.
I agree with that. I agree completely with that.
All right. Well, we understand your position. How about on the merits?
On the merits? First of all, let me deal with the with what we want here. What we want is a reversal of the non-infringement finding so that we can proceed with the case on infringement, both under the doctrine of equivalence and under literal infringement, and also on the breach of contract. We think that there's clearly undisputed issues of fact on both of those, on all of those grounds. Disputed issues of fact, yes. And also, with regard to the question of literal infringement, we think that that can be taken care of in terms of the undisputed facts which are before this court in terms of claim construction. There really is not too much issue there.
I don't understand you to be asking for a remand. I read page 66 of your brief is saying you're entitled to summary judgment in your favor right now, and that and that there should be a reversal with respect to the confidentiality agreement.
Yes, that's right. The point is that.
Am I right then that you're not asking for a remand on anything? You're asking for a total victory right here by this court.
No, that's not what we're asking for. What we're asking for is the is the finding of infringement, literal infringement, which was raised by our partial summary judgment. That's what we're asking for. And sending it back for decision reversal and trial with regard to the infringement claims, and also with regard to the defenses that were raised, invalidity and enforceability.
Stop me ask the selectively applying force limitation. There was an original claim construction, correct?
Yes.
Then it appears that when the judge was considering the motions for summary judgment, she basically kind of altered that construction. Is that whether either construction was right or wrong is not my question. Was there sort of an alteration of the construction at that point?
It looks like there was, yes.
Okay.
And the point I'm making with regard to that is irregardless of the construction made, that what that means is the selection by the force-producing assembly will change the degree of angular displacement of the guide member. And that is a selective element of the claim. That's clear from the...
The other issue, the horizontally oriented body pad and the transverse support, those, as I looked at the record that we have in the appendix, those limitations were not construed by the district court. Rather, in summary judgment, as I looked at the little claim construction chart that she had, and it says, I think, no construction necessary. But then in the summary judgment proceedings, it does appear, then in the summary judgment proceedings, she says, nevertheless, there's no issue of fact. The AB lounge cannot meet these, and she goes into the discussion of the single piece of material. So, is the district court judge in the summary judgment bringing in a claim construction, or is she simply ruling on what she perceives to be no issue of dispute, no genuine issue of material fact? My question wandered a bit.
I think I do. And let
apologize
me try.
For a little.
That's quite all right. I understand. Let me try to respond to it. With regard to the horizontally oriented limitation, there was agreement at the Markman hearing as to what that meant. And we submitted, after close of discovery, we submitted our expert reports based on the claim construction as we understood it and as the parties agreed to it at the Markman hearing. This whole idea of reinterpreting...
There was no construction of the term.
That's right, because the parties agreed.
What was the construction they agreed to?
What they agreed to was that it doesn't have to be on a horizontal plane. It actually could move and be in an angle during the exercise. That's what the parties agreed.
But it seems what we're left with now is what's dispositive of the interpretation of that is what end means, right?
Exactly. Let me try to get.
Was there any construction of the word end?
There was no construction of the word end.
Well, therefore, I think maybe this is piggybacking what Judge Shaw said. It seems to me, reading her opinion, whether she calls it plain construction or not, she construes end to be a clear boundary. And based on that, she says there's no clear boundary in the infringing device.
Fair statement. Okay. The point is that,
so
the claim doesn't call for that. The claim just calls for an end to the body pad.
What do you think end means? How would you construe that?
Where it stops.
Do you disagree that it's a clear boundary?
Where it stops.
With what's?
The point is that she found that the fabric, in part, the upper part of the fabric was the chair back. The lower part of the fabric was the seat. If you look at the manuals, which we've given in our briefs, clearly, they understood that there was an end. There was a place where the seat back stopped and the seat began. That was the end. The court asked in questions, measure the body pad or seat force. Both sides submitted experts, and those experts...
Right, and the district court goes through those experts.
Well, she says...
Your expert, correct?
Yeah, both experts. And actually, they both measure 3 4-tenths apart in terms of their distance. Both recognized there was an N. Both recognized there was an N.
But you're saying we should construe N exclusively to mean a seat region, right? There's no reference in the claim language to a seat region.
Yes, there is. It calls for the first N of the body pad.
Yes.
And that's what I'm saying. There's a first N of the body pad.
And you're construing that first N to be the seat region.
Exactly.
Doing that to be the bottom. No, all I'm saying is that it doesn't say that. You're providing your own interpretation.
Well, I think the patent makes clear that the lower part of the body is the part that is the body pad. And the guide member is supporting the torso. That's made clear in the claim.
You want to save the rest of your rebuttal time?
Yes, I can.
Thank you, Mr. Fine. Mr. Mobile. Pronouncing your name correctly?
Yes, Paul, thank you.
Paul, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you very much. And please support. I'd like to just start off and address the jurisdictional question briefly. I think the confusion may be that with respect to the unenforceability counterclaim, I think is what's referred to in the order. It's really an unenforceability claim because we brought the action as a declaratory action. But there was not a declaratory judgment action on unenforceability. It was just on invalidity and non-infringement. There was a passing reference to the patent being unenforceable, but if you look at the caption on the declaratory judgment claim in question, it only refers to invalidity and non-infringement. So I think that may explain why the district court never thought that she had an unenforceability counterclaim. Unenforceability was an issue by virtue of a defense that was asserted of inequitable conduct. Okay. So if I can move on to the merits. I just want to address the dispositive issues with respect to selectively applying a force. We've stated a position in our brief that it was clear that there was an estoppel. Mr. Monti had argued for a claim construction at Markman that said that selectively applying.
What sort of estoppel are you asserting?
It's a judicial estoppel.
Where do we have a ruling of the court on the merits of the case that was based on acceptance of that earlier position?
I'm not aware of any precedent that this court has where it stops a party.
No, I think Chief Judge Michel was asking, where in this case do you have a ruling, and he'll correct me if I'm wrong, but where in this case do you have a ruling showing the court relying on the statements that were made with respect to the 250-pound man and the 120-pound man?
Mm-hmm.
I think he's talking about in this case, where do you have it?
The court's summary judgment order refers to a reliance on that doctrine and preventing Mr. Monti from taking a position contrary to what he took at Markman, which was that the force applied by the
But her original claim construction, and correct me if I'm wrong, but her original claim construction didn't seem to take into account any, input, if you will, from the weight of the user of the device. The claim instruction simply says the force-producing assembly applying an appropriate force to bias the guide member as needed during the exercise. And
yeah,
I mean, I don't.
She clearly doesn't. I see what your point is. She clearly doesn't.
A basis for judicial estoppel here. Assuming it's properly.
Well, I think what she was saying was the way I understood you to argue this construction appropriate as needed was by reference to the force-producing assembly applying a different force to different users. She seizes on the language of made the argument at Markman how the force-producing assembly itself was selective. and it asking itself, how much energy do I need to have this person, okay, he's referring to two different people, the 120-pound and the 220-pound person. How much energy do I have? I need to have this person complete the exercise. That's where the selection is.
I think you're responding to the problem that Judge Scholl and I are trying to focus on. It's a requirement of judicial estoppel that the court have relied on the position previously taken by the party to be estopped. Mm-hmm. Certainly, there was a different position articulated by your opponent at the Markman hearing compared to in the summary judgment papers. But where is there an adoption and reliance on the earlier position by the district judge?
The best way I can answer it, I think, is that she had an understanding based on arguments and evidence that were put in front of her that the way the force producing assembly worked in the patent was it selected the force as a function of the user, and there was argument for support for that, this idea of a self-regulating force they cited her to in the specification, and then said
you're saying there's this kind of a I don't want to say subsequently, but you're saying there's an implied reliance. I guess what the argument you're making is there's an implied reliance on the example that was given in the colloquy during the Markman hearing in the word appropriate.
Yes, appropriate as needed.
Appropriate as appropriate force. That's your argument?
That's right. They argued for that particular construction, appropriate as needed. And I think what the court said was, well, what she understood them to mean by appropriate as needed is that force-producing assembly will apply a different force depending on the user, what the weight of the user is. That's the only example that they gave, and they repeated that twice in the record.
Looking at the other thing, Mr. Stein said that getting to the other limitations, mm-hmm. we were discussing with Mr. Stein, the body pad and the other one was.
Transversely oriented support.
Right, yes, that's it. Thank you. there was clearly no claim construction, but he said that the parties agreed on what that turned in, and I think Judge Prost asked, where's that agreement? Do we see, can you?
No, there was no agreement on that. They, in fact, at Markman, there was a discussion of what body pad meant. There was an argument made by Fitness Quest as what body pad meant, or at least the way it was discussed in the patent. Mr. Monti said no construction was required of body pad. Ultimately, the court said no construction is required.
But in order to determine what the infringement question with respect to that, doesn't have to construe what the word end means?
I don't think it's necessary.
Doesn't the infringement question turn on the meaning of end?
It does. Ultimately, it does. But one of the questions that was asked, and I think you piggybacked on Judge Shaw's question about, well, is this just a straightforward application of the claims? And I don't want to mischaracterize your words, but
no, go ahead.
Application of the
you
claims.
Probably say it better than I did.
To the accused product, and the answer to that question is yes. The patent claims require an end. There's in the body pad. The only end in the one-piece fabric that's at that particular boundary that was of concern was at the very top of the device.
Well, let me ask
device.
You, if in the infringing product it's one piece of fabric, but if there were like a little seam etched in and a little instruction, upper body goes above this line, lower body goes below that, would you concede that would be an end to the lower body?
No, I think as the district court said that, there had to be a clear...
Didn't she say there's ambiguity as to where exactly this line is? But what if there's a seam?
Well, I guess a seam would still... there isn't a seam, but if there's a seam, I guess there's a boundary in a sense, but there's not really an end because it's one continuous... It's still one
well,
continuous...
Well, that's a little... unclear, because you kind of suggest that N has a clear, ordinary meaning, and therefore there was no need for construction, but it seems like the judge did, in a way, construe it, and she says a clear boundary. Mm-hmm. But now your answer to the question is, even there, if there's a clear boundary, that's not sufficient situation.
Well, what I meant by that is not, is that if she used boundary in this case, I think, because there's clearly wasn't in the one piece fabric with no seam. There's no end and there's really no boundary.
Whereas the example that you correct? I mean, she relied on the fact that you look at the X word and there's all this ambiguity. I don't know where to lay that boundary, but we're talking about an infinitesimal amount. The difference between all of these calculations is very small, right?
Well, actually, what happened with the experts is if you looked at the expert reports, there was actually, I think in the end, there were five different discussions of where what the body pad represented in the ab lounge. So ultimately, if you're just talking about the seat, what the court had asked the parties to do is measure what they regard as the seat, not the body pad, the seat. And there was some difference in what their measurements were. It was a fairly small difference.
You're saying that doesn't matter.
That doesn't matter because the claim requires a body pad. And you know, just if I could note a couple of things on selectively applying a force. The only way we think that you can reach infringement of that limitation is with the ab lounge. Is to read out the term selectively. The argument now made for infringement is selectively means just a force that's applied based on a given angular orientation of the guide member.
Like bungee cords.
Well, in the accused product, yes, the bungee cords. That's the corresponding, what they say is the corresponding force-producing assembly. And in their own expert admitted in testing that he did it in support of an infringement opinion that the force applied by the bungees is solely a function of how far they're stretched. That's it. There's no weight. You don't take into consideration user weight or any other factor. It's just a matter of how far those bungees are stretched. And in our view, is completely inconsistent with not only what they argued at Markman, but what the patent says in terms of what selection means. Now, to be sure, the patent really only talks about user selection. It doesn't talk about the selection of a force-producing assembly. Now, Mr. Stein says, well, that's in the patent. And I think you look in vain for any reference at all to the force-producing assembly itself. Selectively applying a force. That's a distinction that they made based on Claim 15 and Claim 16, but there's no discussion whatsoever of that in the patent. So to find infringement in this case based on meeting that limitation effectively reads that selectively out of the case. Now they said, one other point of a factual dispute is they said, well, their expert, Dr. Prawl, said that the force applied by the bungees is affected by the user. That's false. What Dr. Prawl said was he was looking at tests performed by FitnessQuest expert Dr. Brienza, which he was measuring what's the total force on the chair back, all the forces. So not only the force produced by the bungees, but the force produced by the weight of the user, friction, and the weight of the chair back. All those forces. And what he said was, well, the forces, the overall forces, are going to be different depending on the weight of the user. That's a very, very different point than saying that the force applied by the bungees, again, what they say is the force-producing assembly is changes with the user weight. There's absolutely no support for that. Just a couple of points on the limitation limitations horizontally oriented body support. The only equivalence argument made was the belated argument for equivalence well after expert discovery and in opposition to summary judgment motion. The district court properly refused to consider that late-breaking equivalence argument. And as to two-into-one, they rely on this two-into-one doctrine. Initially, they said it's doctrine of equivalence. I think they've abandoned that. They originally said it was literal and doctrine of equivalence. I think they've abandoned that. They rely on the Sunstuds case. The Dolly case, which distinguishes Sunstuds, says you can't rely on the doctrine of equivalence to remove limitations. You can't combine two claim components together under the doctrine of equivalence where there are limitations relating to those components that would effectively be erased. So even if they were to be permitted to assert an equivalence case, the two-into-one doctrine doesn't help them. As for the breach of contract case, they did not defend on the same grounds below.
Did Mr. Stein argue that? I don't remember him arguing.
He didn't argue.
It's proper for you to argue it. He has it in his brief. You have your response in your brief. And right. You should leave it there.
Well, right, if I could just say one thing, Your Honor, on that is the cases that they rely on, that they can argue it now for the first time on appeal because of the sufficiency, what they say is a lack of sufficiency, those cases stand for the simple proposition that an uncontested motion for summary judgment can't be granted. The court has to actually look at the evidence. That's what this court did. They looked at all the evidence and found it was quite favorable on that point.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Stein.
Thank you.
4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me clear up something right away, and that is the question of whether there is a difference in position by Mr. Monti between the Markman hearing and the now. And I'd like to point to two things. First of all, I'd like to point you to the graph, which is on page 13 of our blue brief, and that really is the evidence that the measurements that were made by Dr. Proud. They were adopted by Fitness Quest. There was no dispute on them. The district court never touched those, never even commented on them. And what that shows is, as you have the angular displacement, there's a selective force provided by the force-producing assembly. Whether the force-producing assembly is a bungee, or whether it's a gas spring, as described in the preferred embodiments, the undisputed evidence is they both act the same. And the point is that the weight comes in because how that's going to respond to different users is going to be different. Now, sure, if somebody stands beside the unit and moves it down, they're not on the unit. But this is during the exercise. Furthermore, it's going to respond very differently depending on what the torso weight is of different people. I'd like to point you to page 15 of our gray brief, where we quote the evidence from Dr. Prowl with regard to commenting on Brenza's test. Now, Brenza's test were with a dummy. Dummy had no arms, no head. All it had was a body part, and it was a clear one piece. And what he says is, whether you have a 400-pound man or whether you have a 100-pound woman, it's going to make it very different as to how that responds. How is it going to make it different? It's going to make it different in terms of how much you go back and how far you go back based on the weight of the user. That's the point. And that's the point we were making from the beginning. It's the point that we made at the hearing on the infringement. There was really no difference. Sure, we refined our position because at the Markman hearing.
So where are we left now? What you say is that summary judgment is it reversing it, or is it saying that there's a factual issue with regard to infringement and we ought to send it back for trial?
I think that at least you should send it back for trial. But I submit to you that there really isn't any dispute as to how the machine operates, and the fact that based on the claim construction, your honors can enter a judgment of infringement. The question of
based on the claim construction, what's the claim construction?
claim construction is that
the original judge's claim construction.
Yes, exactly. Or the one that she had her modification. Either one, you come out the same way. The point is that the weight of the user, contrary to what the district court said, there was an undisputed fact that the weight did not have an impact on the avalanche. In fact, it does. And the undisputed evidence is that it does. And the undisputed evidence is that the preferred embodiments in the patent operate precisely the same way. Let me just respond on a couple other points. With regard to the horizontal orientation, it was at the Markman hearing, Fitness Tech took the position that the horizontal oriented meant that the body pad could be angled. And so our position was, it's an undisputed issue. There's no reason for making any claim construction on this because the parties agree. This whole idea that we late presented our position is just wrong. We relied on what the position was of Fitness Quest in answers to interrogatories, and it wasn't until after discovery was closed, we submitted our expert report in a rebuttal report and in the motion for summary judgment, do they raise the issue of this court changed their position on interpretation of horizontally oriented. At that point, we did the right thing. We submitted an expert report on it. We also offered that expert for cross-examination. And they didn't take us up on the cross-examination. The court didn't allow the expert deposition to be taken. That was the point that we were making.
All right. I think we have the positions of both sides clearly in mind. We thank both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All rise.